Hi and welcome to episode 111 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. We are recording on the 20th of December 2020. I am Vikram Mohan, as usual, reminding you to check the last episode of Binge On for this season. Yes, the last episode for this year is out and we have four Indian road movies for you. So check that out. Both Binge On and WhatsApp Geeks will be back early 2021. We'll keep you updated. And now back to Attention Plus and let's get your host in. Arnab.
Hello.
Hey, Arnab.
Hi, Vikram.
Arnab, now that we know that the farmers' protests was a very well-staged diversion by the government so that we don't pay attention to the state of our test cricket team, we know that for sure, right? All that has been a diversion.
I hope it was. I hope there is enough diversions to divert. COVID also was a diversion, I guess, too.
Absolutely. Yes. So what I want to ask you is, can we at least now send Ravi Shastri with a tanki of his favorite beverage to the Mardarshak Mandali, right? That's what the old folks' home is called.
I think Ravi Shastri should go back to become an IPL commentator. I mean, he was doing very well there. I mean, he had the Shaz and Waz show. I mean, this talk is cheap. And you know, that's why you're listening to the podcast, because talk indeed is cheap. And you don't pay for it, and I don't want to pay for anything that Ravi Shastri does either. And he should definitely go back to. I am trying not to use an obscenity, but essentially, you know, hand pleasuring the board of Cricket Control of India as a commentator, and he was particularly good at it. So in terms of cliches and a total lack of insight, he was excellent, and I think that's what. And of course, he could obviously rev up the lack of excitement in IPL. I mean, he was a very good IPL commentator in the sense that he could create sensation out of nothing and manufacture enthusiasm. But as a cricket coach, he's been, as we all know, and we've discussed this, and anybody with half a brain knows that Ravi Shastri is not a cricket coach. He's essentially a yes man who's been installed by the captain so that you know, in generally in a functioning sporting unit, the coach, especially in cricket, I would say, where it's not so much in soccer where the football is where the captain is a mere figurehead, but in particularly in something like cricket, the coach is usually there as kind of a check and to provide checks and balances on the captain's power. In any kind of functioning organization, which is if you look at the corporate structures, there are always this checks and balances, where there is in government, where there is in corporate governance, there's always checks and balances. You don't let one person become a dictator. Unfortunately, in Indian cricket, Virat Kohli, and he's not the first person, but he's been perhaps been the most brazen, which kind of keeps in with this hard arrogance that he reeks of, that he has appointed somebody who's essentially, again, a glorified hand pleasurer, I would say, in terms of Virat Kohli was given a very good coaching staff. He was given Anil Kumble, he was given Saheed Khan, and he decided that, you know, those people will get in his way. They will tell him that he's wrong. And if there's one thing that Virat Kohli and his IT cell on Twitter cannot hear, is the fact that he can be wrong. See, just because he is a great batsman, and there is nobody's doubting the fact that he is, doesn't mean that he is infallible or that. And his performance as the captain of RCB shows that even for a simple thing, much simpler thing than test cricket, which is IPL, he cannot captain a winning side. Even if you provide him great resources, he just cannot make it work. So there is a lot that he needs to learn as a captain, though he doesn't think that there is, but he should. And ultimately, the fact is, that's why you need a coach to cut somebody as arrogant as Kohli down to size. Unfortunately, the board, and based on, I would say, Virat Kohli's significant the corporate clout that he has, and nobody can claim that the BCCI is also particularly a very upright and honest organization in many ways, that they also caved in to the financial clout that Virat Kohli has. And what they have done is they have created essentially, and Sourav Ganguly, who's I have admired for a long time, is also responsible for this, because there was an expectation that he would come in and that he would break the back of, and it was very well known that he never wanted Ravi Shastri to be the coach. But even he, you know, whether it be a compromise which the Shah family has foisted on us, I have no idea. But the fact is that Sourav Ganguly has been in his job for 2 years. And the fact that Ravi Shastri hasn't been kicked out on the street, Boria Bistar, with a begging bowl, is proof enough that something hasn't been done, because that is what should have been done. Again, what happened yesterday isn't Ravi Shastri's fault in its entirety, obviously not. The fact that he is an ineffective coach and that he's just there to sleep, as he's publicly caught sleeping while the game is going on, that he's hardly engaged, he doesn't care, and he knows that, you know, he's not there to make his input heard, that he's merely a figurehead, so he sleeps. I think that's at least honest. So given the fact that he's absolutely ineffectual, yesterday's terrible display, spineless, gutless display, you really can't blame him. What he is in, the blame lies at the feet of Virat Kohli, who has created an absolute North Korea-like state in Indian cricket, that whoever is in good books of him stays, whoever isn't gets out, and that he uses the traction that he has based on his undoubted cricketing skills as well as the commercial strength that he has to enhance his position. That is what should be called out, and that is what I'm going to call out today. It is tragic to see that many of these cricket-themed websites and sports-themed websites don't have the balls to say anything about Virat Kohli today. Not a single smidgen of gonads were displayed. It was, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason why nobody wants to say anything. And Dhoni was no better in this respect, by the way. There is no room, and people say, "Ye to sab Modi ji karte hain." Seriously, this is the way power structures in India work. So just like you have Modi ji channels, you have, in this case, you have Kohli ji channels and Kohli ji websites. And the reason why they're Kohli ji websites is because everything that they do is based on access. If they piss off Kohli by writing anything which is against him, then they are guaranteed to be shut out from any kind of access from within the Indian cricket team. And so you have the soft apology written for, again, I'll repeat those words because they are powerful words, gutless and spineless display from the Indian team yesterday. In front of a bowling attack, which was good, very good, but that's what Test cricket is, my friend. Test cricket isn't Pat Cummins coming in and putting in 50% or 40% for KKR and taking his check or leaving. It's not Glenn Maxwell, essentially, as Sehwag said, being a 10 crore cheerleader, and then just 3 days later, turning on his actual game and then laughing while he's doing it in the faces of the Indians who were fools to pay him money. So this, again, this is perhaps, and I'll come back to it, why yesterday's was such a terrible slap in the face of those of us who are left, who are actually passionate about Test cricket and who actually follow it. And before we get into that, let's just first talk about Prithvi Shaw and his selection. Again, what happened tomorrow has got nothing to do with Prithvi Shaw, but the fact is we started off this game with 10 players. And Prithvi Shaw coming into this, and my hypothesis is maybe somebody made a call to Ravi Shastri and said, "Do whatever Mr. Shaw tells you." And Ravi Shastri, a few pegs down, heard Shaw. Karenge, karenge. He says, "Jee, Shaw ji, opening kijiye. Jo chahiye ab kijiye." So Prithvi Shaw had a terrible IPL season. Now, one can say, well, a good IPL season doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have a good... That's true. But if you had a bad IPL season, which is a much lesser game than Test cricket, you're guaranteed to have a terrible Test season. And I don't know, Vikram, if you saw the commentary that Ricky Ponting was doing when he got out.
No, I didn't. I didn't see the match.
So when Prithvi Shaw came to bat, Ricky Ponting was saying, because Ricky Ponting was his coach in Delhi Capitals, that, you know, he's a very good batsman, but he has this problem that when the ball comes in, it's slanted across him and it comes in, he gets bowled. And he said that, and within 3 seconds, he was bowled exactly like that. So at this point of time, I mean, if Ricky Ponting, who's his coach, knows it, he obviously told the Australians, and they're smart enough to know it themselves. I mean, I'm not saying Ricky Ponting went and told them, but he has very, very obvious problems with his batting. And when people say, and the problem with this is, I don't know what kind of influence is getting Prithvi Shaw into the side. It's definitely not cricket. But unfortunately, if indeed he is somebody who seemed to be extremely talented, they're actually setting him up to fail. This series might very well have ended his career, by the way, if he cannot come, because he's a very young guy, right? And if he's seen to be the future of Indian cricket, rather than throwing him into the deep end at a time when he's obviously not there, this is doing much more harm to him than good. I mean, he's becoming the butt of memes, and given the age and given the kind of social media pressure that I'm pretty sure all these cricketers are on social media, given his age, and to check it, this is not doing anything good for him in terms of making him a better player. So I understand why there is a case for Prithvi Shaw. The modern approach to test cricket is that test cricket cannot, and there is some truth to this, obviously, that in a well-balanced test side, you need somebody who is aggressive. You cannot have a bunch of Cheteshwar Pujaras in the side. You have to have a few aggressive cricketers interspersed with slower cricketers. You need a Sehwag, for instance. And we've been trying to find a Sehwag, but Sehwag, again, is a freak. He was a freak of nature. He's not like, you know, people talk about Sachin Tendulkar, but the actual real freak was Sehwag. There's very few people who, given the kind of cricket he played, was better in test cricket than he was in T20, which is really strange. But that was the thing about Sehwag. You could have Sehwag who would score a 194 in Australia on a very juiced up pitch. You know, you use that innings, you don't even see how difficult that pitch was to bat till the others Indians started batting. So you cannot expect, Prithvi Shaw is not Virendra Sehwag. He might be Virendra Sehwag someday, I don't know. But he's definitely nowhere close to Virendra Sehwag at this point of time in his career. And we had a lengthy T20 season in IPL where his technical shortcomings were adequately exposed on much friendlier pitches in front of much more friendly bowling. So what was exactly the Indian Cricket Administration thinking in terms of what was going to happen to him in Australia in day-night tests with a pink ball, with Australian bowlers actually giving their full energies and the full weight of their cricketing talent? Most Australian players, and I've said this before in this podcast, they come to the IPL, they encash their check, and they play half-assed cricket and go home. And it's a pity that we keep on selecting them year after year. Beyond their some exceptions, I think the biggest exception, as I've repeatedly said, is David Warner. He actually does give his heart and, you know, he gives his heart and soul into IPL. And it shows. If you look at his performance, you know, it shows. Other than that, I don't think there's any Australian cricketer. I mean, Ricky Ponting, for instance. He was laughing, I remember, when he came. I mean, the whole thing was they don't take India seriously. I mean, they take India's money seriously, but they don't take India seriously. So there's the general Australian attitude. There are very few exceptions of people who actually take IPL seriously. That when they take the money, they put in their 100%. As I said, I think only David Warner is a name that I can think of, who consistently does that. And another reason, as I've said before, I think the reason why David Warner does that, and I'm kind of extrapolating here, is because David Warner is never going to be the captain of the Australian team. And only in the Hyderabad franchise is he given that responsibility of being a captain. And I think he enjoys that. I think he plays like that because they have given him that responsibility. If somebody else was captain, I don't know how he would have played. I think the fact that the franchise depends on him and they make it so clear that he is their number one guy and he's their captain, he's their leader, I think he doesn't want to let that go. I think with Maxwell on these guys, nobody makes them captain. They just come in and just basically do garmasti. That's all. I think the technical term is called garmasti, what they do in IPL. Now, the problem now, so Prithvi Shaw, again, I think Prithvi Shaw has been exposed. He might play in further tests. He might have a good innings, but I don't think that's going to happen. And this is...
You really sounded like your namesake for a minute. Prithvi Shaw, you've been exposed.
Yes, you have not been exposed by me. The difference between my namesake and me is I don't take the claim for exposing.
I just wish we could have a flaming hashtag Prithvi exposed coming on if you were in a video.
Now, let's now look at the real reason of to what happened. And I think Joy Bhattacharya on the Twitter thread, he actually said this. My take is a little bit different, but it's related to it. The problem with Indian batsmen is that given, and this is true for Indian batsmen only and some other countries. So there are now, I believe, two classes of countries in the cricket playing nation. Those who prioritize T20 cricket over tests and those who prioritize test cricket over T20s. The prominent examples of countries which fall in the first category are India and West Indies. So West Indies, for instance, is a very extreme case of this. Because their cricketing structure has been so dysfunctional functionally, in terms of finance, and the fact that, you know, their cricketers, when they play for West Indies, they believe they're underpaid. So many of them basically stop playing. They don't want to sign on to contracts. They would rather prefer to play in T20 leagues. There's an entire generation of West Indian cricketers who have zero test cricket technique now, but who are very, very good T20 players. Because this is what they prioritize. Because, you know, test, there are two distinct games, T20 and tests. They're, you know, we call them cricket, but they have the same rules, but they're very, very different sports. They're very different sports because particularly in the realm of batsmanship, where you're basically batting based on your subconscious instinct. You don't think when you do your footwork. When people in commentary box and people like us, we can say, right foot moving, left foot moving, left elbow pointing toward cover point and all that shit. But, you know, when you're really in the heat of it, nobody thinks on those lines. You know, the ball comes out and your body automatically takes a position. You don't have time to think. So this is a part of conditioning. How do these things happen? It's a part of, that's why practice. You are conditioned to get into the right pose just through practice. It's a kind of, you know, secondary brain, you know, you basically, it's a kind of Pavlovian reaction at this point of time. You're not thinking anything. Now, most Indians, especially as they optimize, their Pavlovian response is geared to the T20 game. And again, the extreme example is West Indies. Extreme example. In the 80s, 70s, they used to produce great test match batsmen. They were producing the Chandrapals and they were producing, you know, very, very good test match batsmen even then, the Carl Hoopers. Not even talking about West Indians in their, you know, in their sunshine years. Talking about West Indies after their sunshine years. Even at that point of time, they were producing good test match batsmen. Now they produce zero, absolutely zero. Tell me one good West Indies test match batsman. One, there isn't one. But they have a solid T20 team. They can have, in the T20 World Cup, they can have two West Indian T20 sides which can go into the quarterfinals. They're that good. If all of them are fit, they have 22 players who are that good in T20. But none of them would make the test team.
Because Joy's point, of course, was also that this is not necessarily good or bad, right? I mean, it's just the way it is.
These are two distinct, that's what I'm saying. These are two distinct sports. It's who decides to take priority over what? Now, the Indians, on the other hand, Australians and English and New Zealand, they have solidly thrown in still for test cricket. You will find that Australians, you'll find the Starks and all of these people, they intentionally, they skip IPL. They have money. I mean, Stark got a shitload of money from KKR. Minor injury, he won't come. And we sometimes wonder, and this whole thing as to why the Australians sometimes, don't put in that amount of effort in IPL, because their mind is on Ashes. If they have an Ashes test in front of them, that's really all they care for. It's not a question of money. And they'll get 10 times that money playing in IPL. You know, if Maxwell has a great season, he will get that same amount of money next year. He'll get even more. So it's not even that they're thinking in terms of money. They know that, okay, this money though I have cashed in. I already have $1 million. Kya hoga aur 1 million leke? Ho gaya na mere life ke liye. Main set ho gaya. The problem with Indian cricket is they never set. Now they have to do other things also. So for Indian cricket, it's not a money. It's the thing is I have to get more and more money in IPL. So they prioritize that instinctual cricket is prioritized on scoring runs, on how to score runs. The biggest example was, if you remember, there's this catch which Bumrah missed.
Yep.
He ran. It was a catch of Marnus Lebuchan. This is fielding. He jumped trying to stop it from going for a six. And he missed the catch. He was nowhere close to the boundary. If he had tried to go for a catch, he would have caught it. He could have taken a few steps and he would have still been in the boundary. But his first instinct was to jump and prevent it from going for a six because he felt he was close to the boundary line. Which game do you think prioritize? Which kind of game do you think prioritize saving a six over getting a wicket? Right? So that's the thing with him. At that moment, I'd written on Twitter that this is the thing about Ambani. When they get a hold of you, they get hold of your brain, you know, the condition reflex. You will always optimize for Ambani, no matter where you are. So his Mumbai Indians' brain is working at that point of time. He tries to stop a six when he has the number two Australian batsman. He could get him out cheap. And again, it's not something which he consciously thinks of. Again, at that point of time, nobody's consciously thinking that, am I in a test match? Is this Marnus Lebuchan? What will happen? Of course, he knows this. Of course, you know, anybody in the Indian test cricket team knows much more about cricket than I do or you do or anybody who's listening to this. So none of this is news to Jasprit Bumrah. But at that moment, his brain has been so conditioned by the amount of training that he's gone through in order to succeed for Mumbai Indians that he thinks that he's there. That this is actually perhaps, Chris Lynn from Kolkata Knight Riders hitting the ball to prevent it from going for a six. Now, take that. That was such a visible example of what happens from this kind of T20 IPL conditioning. Now, take it to the batting that got us out for 36. Now, let's first get the obvious things out of the way. This was a difficult pitch to bat on. By the time the Indians came out to bat for the second innings, they had a fairly decent lead on a low-scoring game. All they needed to do was put perhaps 150 runs on the board, and this would have been a real tight match. I'm not saying they would have still won, but it would have been a reasonably tight match. Now, the pitch, the Adelaide pitch, had, and again, I think Wasim Jaffer made this point. It was a perfectly fine point that if in India, if a pitch like this would have been prepared, there would be an ICC investigation. But since it's in Australia, there is none. This is considered to be a great pitch. But anyways, keeping that to the side, test matches, I believe, have to be played. I mean, that's the reason why it's a test match. You know, one-day matches in T20 make feather beds and have, you know, people just hitting sixes. That's fine. But cricket has to be a contest where the ball, because the rules of the game are so biased in favor of the bat, in order for an exciting contest, the pitch has to be biased in favor of the bowlers. So as a pitch, this is the kind of pitch I want to see test cricket being played on, which actually challenges batsmen. And since I love test cricket, I don't want batsmen to be challenged on how many runs they can score, how fast. If I wanted to see that, I would see it in T20. So this game is exercising a totally different set of skills. Now, This is an Indian side. Let's first get the obvious things out of the way. One of the complaints that the Indian side has traditionally had with foreign twos is that of the scheduling, that we have a first test, we arrive like 3 days or 4 days before the first test, we might get a game or we might not, and then we are dropped straight into a pitch against the top-ranked bowlers of the opponent, and we are not acclimatized, and we lose the first test, and after that, we are always playing catch-up. This time, that was not what happened. These guys have been there for more than a month now. They played T20, they played one days. They should have, at this point of time, been acclimatized. There should have been no jet lag. They should have been acclimatized to the conditions at this point of time. They actually did play decently in the first innings also. So you would say, what really happened? Well, first thing that happened was the pitch kept on getting faster. And secondly is, because of the pitch conditions at that point of time, it also started swinging. So if you look at the dismissals, all of them, the ball swung out. And that's why they went out. So the deliveries which the batsmen were able to keep out were the ones which were swinging in, and then when it swung out, they edged behind. Now, when the Indians came on to bowl, why didn't the Indians get them out for 45? Why didn't that happen? Well, this is where the difference is. This is where the real thing is, which, you know, the Godi media version of sport journalism, war journalists won't tell you. Is the fact is that the Indian batsmen are not optimized to play. I mean, some people like Cheteshwar Pujara might be the exception, but they cannot play the swinging ball. They can play, if the ball swings even a little bit, the entire T20 batting conditioning works against you. The main thing about how to play swing is your foot goes back and across. While in T20 and any kind of cricket where you're asked to play fast, your foot actually goes the other way in order to give you the space to swing your bat. One of the persons whose batting technique has gone worse is Ajinkya Rahane. When he started off, he used to play the right way. And then because his numbers in T20, and it didn't really help him in T20 either, by the way, but he tried at that point of time, he tried to change his technique to become kind of a more a power hitter, which is getting your foot outside the line of the ball, giving yourself space. The extreme example is the way Chris Gayle plays. So that technique has now dominated. So you find that the first thing is to, and if you want to say it's Mayank Agarwal who does it a lot. And Mayank Agarwal is a decent batsman. I don't think he'll be a great batsman, but he's a decent batsman. He had a good series last time. And again, this was a difficult pitch. These bowlers were bowling perfectly for that pitch. But there's no reason why a test side, international level, should be all out for 36. There should be somebody in the side who can at least score a 50, get the side to 100 runs, at least. The fact that there was none. Now, why do collapses happen? Collapses happen because, you know, people, and as people said, it's happened to Australia also. Yeah, it's happened to Australia also. It has happened to other teams also. This is not to say that it doesn't happen to anyone or that it's never, it is, but there is also a difference. And when you get to 36 and 60, there is a difference. I mean, 36 and 61 is almost twice the other. So 36, friggin' 36. And that 36 out of which 9 runs were scored the day before. So just that amount of runs in that period of time, there is nothing that you can say to me. And I've been watching this game for close to like 40 years now. And I haven't seen anything like that, where not one batsman is able to make even 20 runs. I understand the pitch is difficult. I understand they're bowling well. But pitches have been difficult. I mean, that's what a test match is for. And what are you expecting? I mean, three very good pace bowlers who are, unlike in IPL, who are giving their 100%. But the thing is, because we have prioritized and optimized for T20 cricket, we will never be able to, you know, last out these kinds of sessions. And this is exactly what was proven here. You know, if this was a Gavaskar or somebody, they would have lasted it out. I'm absolutely sure. I'm absolutely sure that even a Sachin, you know, even a Sachin or a Lakshman, even those guys would have lasted it out. You just will notice that, you know, this back and across thing. Rahul Dravid had a very prominent movement. Even Lakshman had this movement. And that's why Lakshman sucked at T20. He couldn't play T20. Because this was the last generation. I'm pretty sure if, again, we would possibly not have, we possibly might not have gotten there because we didn't have that good pace bowlers at that point of time. But I'm pretty sure that side wouldn't have fallen for 36. Yeah, we have fallen for, you know, those people also had bad days, terrible days. But at least they could get 20 runs. And this pitch wasn't that bad also. I mean, there are pitches in which the ball basically scoots on the ground, sometimes bumps up, sometimes goes along the ground. The bounce was absolutely fine. It was just that they were bowling very well and the ball was slightly swinging. And sometimes the problem is the biggest challenge is when the ball slightly swings. If the ball swings a lot, then it'll just miss. If it swings slightly, that's the chance that you will get an edge. And you would see one of the things with another T20 thing that most cricketers, Indian batsmen have, is they go at the ball with very, very hard hands. You'd see that's the way Virat Kohli got out, for instance. And this is not the first time he's gotten out in that region. This is how he used to get out to Anderson in England. So if the ball is in a certain place, Virat Kohli cannot not go hard at it. His entire thing is to hit it for a four. And if he's the best batsman and his first instinct is to hit it for a four at that point of time, when he's smart, everybody knows that India is going through a torrid spell. And the great thing about Test cricket is just because these guys have just hitting it, Test cricket always gives you a second chance. If one batsman, and I'm not expecting Hanuma Vihari to do this, but if one of the major, the big three batsmen like a Rahane or a Kohli or a Cheteshwar Pujara, if they last out one session and they go to lunch, it could be very different when they come back from lunch. Because the thing is about rhythm. The bowlers might have lost just that amount of rhythm. The pitch could have changed just that little amount.
You left out Sharmaji.
Which Sharmaji?
The missing Sharmaji.
No. Missing Sharmaji doesn't matter. The fact is he didn't play. One of the things with people is they feel that if this guy didn't play, if only Sharmaji had played, this would have been good. Sharmaji is terrible too in terms of Test cricket. So again, Sharmaji is not a solution. So, and hardly, I would say. So this is not a question about, I saw a meme somewhere that, you know, I like Riddhiman Saha when Pant is playing and I like Pant when Riddhiman Saha is playing. So this is not a question of let's replace this personnel with that. I'm not saying the selection was very wrong except Prithvi Shaw. But, you know, who would have been KL Rahul? I mean, who would have been a better batsman at this point? It would have been KL Rahul, right? Instead of Prithvi Shaw. How well do you think KL Rahul would have done? He has the exact same problems as everybody. If Rahane can't do it, if Cheteshwar Pujara can't do it, if Kohli can't do it, I'm pretty sure KL Rahul can't do it either. So again, this is what the board has to consider is this. And this is perfectly fine to say, look, we give a flying fuck for Test cricket. They don't pay. No, none of you fuckers watch this. So we don't give a fuck. We will play it. If we win, we win. We don't, we don't. But our main priority is T20. But no, they will message it as if it's the opposite thing. While it's so obvious that for none of them, Test cricket is not a priority for Indians. And I would say for West Indians. And for West Indies, I can understand they don't get paid. So they go to the place where it pays them, which I totally get. I think West Indies do exactly what I would have done in their place. They have a set of talents. They will sell their talents where they will get the maximum remuneration. Well, India, you presume that the BCCI has money enough to pay them that amount for Test cricket also. But again, it's a choice. I am perfectly fine that if that's the choice that India has made. But I think that it needs to be called out. And this is, again, a part of the culture which I believe that Kohli has brought into the side, this T20 first kind of culture, which I think if you have a coach like Rahul Dravid or a Zahir Khan or Anil Kumble, you know, people of that generation, you are more likely to find some kind of pushback on that. And that's really why I'm not saying that you don't need to, because tomorrow we'll have a T20 World Cup and people in India will suck at that too. Mind you, this is the problem. See, India, when you try to do both of these things, you know, you end up, you know, riding on both boats, and if the you do pretty well in everything, but you can't make it to the end. That's been the problem of India. I mean, they play decently. They play much better test cricket than they used to. They definitely play decent T20. They play decent one-day internationals. But they can never take that last step because they decide, because they have taken the role of a generalist rather than a specialist. They don't want to specialize. So the option is either to create two distinct teams, because there are very few people who can be equally good in both T20 as well in test. There are very, very few people, even now playing, who are, I mean, AB de Villiers, one of them. Kane Williamson, another one of them. I mean, Joe Root sucks in T20. I would say Steve Smith also sucks in T20. So there are very, very few people who can actually play across all the three. And Kohli does. I mean, he can, but I would say that at a certain level, because yesterday, you know, what is it, and I'll conclude with this, what is it that defines greatness in a cricketer? What do we remember about cricketers once they have retired? It's not the bulk of runs they scored, at least not for me. Who gives a fuck? It's when they scored the runs. It's in what situation they scored the runs. I will forget everything Lakshman has scored, but I'll never forget his innings in Gardens. Because it's not the runs that he scored, it's when he scored the runs. It's when we're facing, you know, we have a great attack, a top-notch Australian attack. We've lost the first test. We're facing follow-on in the second. The series is over. Everything is finished. And this guy makes a last stance. And he changes, essentially, the test series and, in a way, the history of Indian cricket on that day. That's what you remember. It doesn't have to end also in victory. I will never forget Sachin Tendulkar's innings against Pakistan in Chennai. Because why do I do it? Because on a terrible pitch, on a decaying pitch, Saqlain Mushtaq at his absolute peak, Wasim Akram at his peak, amazing bowling attack. This one man is just standing against all of these people. I mean, without him, it would have been another 36 all out that day also on that pitch. But he just refused. I mean, that was the thing. I remember Sunil Gavaskar's last test innings against Pakistan, and many of you will not remember that one, which he scored in 96, I think 96 or 94, again on a crumbling Bangalore pitch. We lost that match. But of all Sunil Gavaskar innings, that's the one that I remember because of the adversity, because of the pitch condition, because any cricket fan knows how easy it is to get out. And this person doesn't. That's what defines greatness. Unfortunately, Kohli and his IT fans his IT cell fans will never understand that. They will never understand what it means. It's not I gave Malinga a big spanking in a game in Australia of no significance whatsoever. It's, some people might remember him because of that, but not me. That doesn't define greatness. That's why nobody will consider Chris Gayle to be great. They will consider Brian Lara to be great because of the way he scored the runs, because of the pitches he scored the runs, because of the fact that there was nobody at the other end. That's why they remember Brian Lara. They will not remember Chris Gayle. Chris Gayle will definitely have more money than Brian Lara. In a way, Chris Gayle is the greatest T20 player ever. His numbers tell you that. But nobody will remember him. Nobody will remember Kyron Pollard. No. Nobody will remember him, Kyron Pollard. But, you know, in terms of if I was to make a T20 franchise and somebody gave me a choice of 11 players, I would select Kyron Pollard, you know, first or second or third pick I would take him. I wouldn't take, you know, many other players who I would like to remember for all time. But that's what defines greatness. And unfortunately, the problem with these people is that they're so taken in with that money thing, they just can't see what greatness in sport is. And one would have expected at least some of the media which focuses on cricket coverage would at least remind them of the fact that this is where India is stopping. And this is what happens when you put, you know, the Sultan of mediocrity, Ravi Shastri, in charge. You know, this is the guy who represents, I mean, from his, you know, modeling for Proline t-shirts, this guy represents mediocrity. And you put him in charge. It's not his beer guzzling and his going to sleep. He is like a government servant who's there just because Bara Sahab is happy at him. That's really, and this is the guy. This is the guy you hope will inspire young, the Prithvi Shaws of the world. I mean, can anybody be inspired by Ravi Shastri? No, the coach. I mean, there has to be some kind of inspiration. You know, where is it coming? What is a young child who's contemplating cricket, what is he seeing in today's game that will make him take up the game? Is there a Sachin Tendulkar-like character? I mean, whatever faults that Sachin Tendulkar has, and there are many, there's no doubt that that man inspired a generation. There's no doubt that Kapil Dev inspired a generation.
Undoubtedly.
You know, why does people remember? Can anybody say what is Kapil Dev's greatest innings? No, most people haven't seen Kapil Dev's greatest innings. It happened when we were 17 for 5. That's what makes it his greatest innings. See, we could have been 36 all out that day too. And, you know, Virat Kohli could have said, yeah, whatever. Oh, what the fuck? It happens. Yeah, sure, it happens. But it didn't. And that's why we remember that game. That's why we won the World Cup. That's why Indian cricket changed. It was because one man scored on that day. He's made 183 runs after we were 17 for 5 on a difficult pitch. See, that's what distinguishes the people that people remember versus the people who make money. Rohit Sharma. What innings of Rohit Sharma will I remember? None. I don't care that he made 200 runs against Sri Lanka. I don't think even Sri Lanka remembers he made 200 runs against them. We have a generation of batsmen who put in good averages, they look good on Trick Info, but they produce nothing that will stand the test of time. Yesterday in Adelaide, they had a chance. Each of them had a chance, whether it be Hanuma Vihari, whether any of them had their chance to become legends. None of them took it because they were just not capable of that. That is what I found shocking, not shocking, perhaps distressing and ultimately saddening. And that's it for this discussion.
Hey, what do you want to watch on TV?
What do you want to watch?
I don't know. What do you want to watch?
Spending more time deciding what to watch than actually watching? Here's help. Binge On is a podcast that has theme-based recommendations on stuff to watch online across Netflix, Amazon, Prime, Hotstar, Disney+, Apple TV, YouTube, and a whole lot more.
Comedies, horror movies, documentaries, love stories, web series, regional Indian language, and lots more. Binge On has recommendations for you. Head over to Forspire.net to subscribe using the podcast app of your choice.
All right. So today's main topic is actually an outcome of a listener email from Bharat Rao. So shout out to Bharat Rao. So can I read out an excerpt from the email?
Sure.
So Bharat writes, and I'm just reading out an excerpt. He says, I understand that you, Arnab, are the only child of your parents from your podcasts. I understand from your podcast, I guess. How hard is it for you to stay away from your parents in the US while they are back in India? Have they made peace with the fact that you will remain in the US throughout your life? Have you ever felt a sort of guilt to move back to India and stay by them? What are the mechanisms you have employed to make sure that their health and mental well-being is taken care of? Or have they been supportive of your stay away from the beginning? So today, I guess you're going to talk about the NRI's guilt, if I could say that.
Well, yeah, sure. So rather than going into, let's just, I mean, this is a very good question. And it's really an uncomfortable question, I would say. But I'll endeavor to try to answer this question. So for me, let's first, there are two parts of the question. Is there's the general I don't stay with my parents guilt. And then there is the how do I cope with it. For me, it's very simple. So some of the questions were directly targeted, you know, addressed to me. So for me, you know, my parents, they are perfectly fine with where I am. My parents themselves came and stayed in the US for a long time, and then they went back, unlike me. I'm speaking for them. I'm not saying they don't miss me, but I think they're perfectly fine with me choosing the US and, you know, my reasons for choosing the US. It was not, it was because I did not get I would say I wasn't going to get the opportunities given the career path that I chose in India. That was the simple reason. There's no other reason why I'm not in India other than that. But for me, the way I handle it in my particular case, I'm not saying this is a general, this will work for everybody. My parents normally come to the US for 2 to 3 months every year. And this allows them to get to know my daughter well. And you know, once they're here, if I go to India, it's more an imposition on them, I believe. Because also it's just too hectic. There's time difference. I mean, you need to stay at a place for, you know, 2 to 3 months in order for you to really feel comfortable in that place. So what I do is, and again, it's becoming increasingly difficult because my parents are getting older. So, you know, making the journey, staying here for 2-3 months. But we've been able to do it. We've been fortunate enough to do this for, you know, the last, I would say, quite a few years. And again, my parents also, and this was again a privilege that my parents had when I was doing my PhD here, my father used to come every 2 years at some point of time, you know, staying for 2-3 years in the US, not in the same state, but as a visiting professor. And I would visit them very frequently. And that was when my father wasn't retired. Now he just comes and stays at my home. But even before that, I've been in the US for 20 years now almost. But for many of these years, my father and my mother actually used to stay in US. In different cities, and I would go and visit them and they would come and visit. So for me, I have, I don't think that if I look over the last 20 years, if I had stayed in India, other than staying in Calcutta, which is not an option, I'll come to that. But if I had stayed in another city in India, I don't think I would have met my parents as much as I've met them in the US. But again, I totally understand this is not perhaps the answer to your question. But the answer to the larger answer to your question, but this was definitely an answer to how did I manage? This is how I managed. Now, let's just look at the options that anybody has today. So the option one is you stay in the same house as your parents, the joint family thing. And my personal opinion is this just doesn't work. It doesn't work in this day and age. You need to have your own privacy. Your parents need to have their own privacy also. It's not just a question of you. Your parents are, we tend to think of our parents as, and this is interesting because I was having a conversation with one of my father's, you know, ex-students, and he was praising my father very highly and saying, you know, he was an amazing professor. And then he said, you know, when he came to class, and maybe I'm not using the exact words that he used, but this was the sense, you know, he had this kind of glamour about him, you know, that other professors didn't have, but he had. And then he said something like, as his son, I'm pretty sure you didn't see him that way. And I said, no, absolutely not. The last word I would use with my father would be glamour. but the fact is that, you know, but when you realize that, you hear that, you realize that your parents, and they're human beings and they're individuals too. And just the way you see them doesn't necessarily mean that that's a sum total of who they are as a person. So they are persons, that the aspects of their personality you as a son or daughter will never be able to see, but which will be very easily seen by other people. I'm pretty sure that will be true for my daughter too. You know, that when she hears, oh my God, my father, you know, that's the thing, you know, you never know. So what I'm trying to say is that in order for somebody to be the person that they actually are, and this holds true both for parents as well as the children, they cannot stay in the same house after some time. this is my opinion. I think that, at least from based on my experience, in this day and age, it doesn't work out well. Now, the other thing, which I think is perhaps the best solution, is to have maintain your separate households, to have your separate, stay in separate apartments, but stay in the same city. So you can visit them. And I think that's perhaps the best solution. The problem is that in today's world, this is just not feasible because you can't stay in the same city. For me, I come from Calcutta. There were no jobs in Calcutta. So it was just not feasible. And of course, then I did my PhD. And for that, there's hardly any jobs in India in my specialization. But if I was going to be limited to Calcutta, then, and this has also happened to some of my friends who have decided, they've taken a conscious choice that they want to stay in the same city as their parents. And that has led to a great curtailment in their potential as professionals. They have been, they have stayed at jobs which I'm pretty sure they would have done much better if they gave themselves and they took a choice. And it's a choice that I applaud, to stay close to their parents. But that does come with a cost. So it's stay in the same city. Now, option three is stay in the same country, but move to a different city, Bangalore. And most people that I know actually do that. They don't stay in Calcutta. Bengalis, their parents are in Calcutta. They go to Bangalore. They perhaps go home, once a year, twice a year. They're always available. They can take a flight and they can come back, or they can stay in a different country. Now, for me, I honestly think that option three and option four, they're not very dissimilar from each other. Now, in COVID times, yes. In COVID times, now getting to India is a huge deal. I'm really scared as to if there's any emergency and I have to go to India at this point of time. But in normal times, normal years, there isn't a huge difference flying from Bangalore to Calcutta or flying from New York to Calcutta. It just takes perhaps 10, 12 more hours. That's all. There's really not much difference. And I had a friend who I was talking to, many years ago, and he said, you guys stay in the US, I stay in Bangalore, but I honestly don't think I see my parents as much as you think I would have been seeing them. And we see them pretty much the same as you do. And I used to, at that point of time, go to India every year. So he said, I think you stay in Calcutta for pretty much the same amount of time that I do. And I stay in Bangalore and you stay in New York. I was a student there. So if you really want to make it happen, you could be pretty regular going to India, and option three and option four can kind of be the same thing. Now, yeah, there are some things which, like, for instance, if you want to be at home during Durga Puja, then yeah, that's like might be a problem. So there is something you lose with option four, but I would still say that option three and option four are not very dissimilar from each other. It's option two. If you can stay in the same city, then it's very good. There's nothing like it, I would say. And I would have loved to do that. I would not have loved to stay in the same house as my parents. And I can confidently say my parents would say the exact same thing about me. But it would have been good to have stayed in the same city. But it's also true that Calcutta is not a place where, given the kind of person that I am, my politics, what I work in, I don't think I'm a fit in that city. So I feel that I feel much more comfortable outside Calcutta, even in other cities in India. Not that I've been there for any appreciable period of time, than I feel in Calcutta, to be very honest. Now, let's try to look at this problem in another way. What do your aging parents want from you? What would I want from my daughter? Let's just turn it around. Look at it from my perspective, because I can't speak for my parents. So one is financial support. Now, if you ask most parents, they say, no, this is not it. But yeah, it is, to an extent, it is financial support, and that can be easily done nowadays. Transferring money and all these things is not a problem. My parents are financially independent. I don't, they don't need any. But if they aren't, if they need money, that's the least of worries. I don't think anybody really takes that seriously. You can always transfer money. That's not a thing. And even if you're staying in the same house, that was pretty much the theme of basically all Bengali movies released in the 80s. Bad kids not paying for their parents' sickness, and they were staying in the same house. So if you don't want to, you can do that if you're staying in the next room also. So, this is neither here nor there. The third thing is companionship. It's just being there. And here again, I believe that with the important thing is regular contact rather than prolonged periods of contact. So I think, and that I think can be done remotely. That, especially with Zoom and video chat, you know, my daughter plays with my parents for hours on end from here. And I don't think there's a significant, I mean, it's good for them, it's good for her. And again, it is the intent. I don't think that companionship, I'll come back to the third thing, which is the really important thing. But the second thing is the companionship, the FaceTime. That also isn't something which you actually need to be there. As a matter of fact, I would say that when I go to India, not when my parents come to here, but when I go to India, I perhaps talk the least to my parents because I'm just doing so many other things when I'm in India. That's the time when I'm possibly the least engaged with India in every respect when I'm actually physically in India. I am much more engaged with India in terms of I know what's going on in India when I'm in the US because I also perhaps interact more with my parents when I'm in US than when I'm sitting right next to them in India. So that's the second thing. So companionship, again, you know, the day-to-day interaction, the checking in, the conversations, that thing also in this day and age, and especially after COVID, we have conditioned ourselves in many ways to realize that in order for us, it's a question of physical distancing rather than social distancing. You don't need to be socially distanced just because you're physically distanced. I think if there is any good that has come out of 2020, any good that has come out of 2020, it's this, that we as a civilization, as a global civilization, have realized this even more than we perhaps have done for the past thousands of years. The technology has ultimately brought us to that level. Now, the third thing, which perhaps is the most important thing, is the emergency situation. You know, they're getting old, you know, who helps them? And yes, that is something which I honestly do feel bad about, that, you know, there are some days in which, again, unless you stay in the same city, you can't do this. This is why option two, you know, just doing something that, and again, this, there is no getting around the fact that, you know, you can't sometimes and you wish you could. And especially in times like COVID and stuff, when you know that this is perhaps even more needed. And yeah, that guilt, I can't say that it's not there. But the only way that I can, you know, cover up the guilt or mitigate for it is basically to, you know, to stay in touch with them, to tell them what's going on in my life. Now, I don't tell, see, one of the things with my, and I understand, and it's not that my parents have told me this explicitly, but I kind of figured this out, that I think really what my parents are looking for and what I would also look for as I grow older and my daughter has her own family is just to be still be part of a family, just for them to know what's going on. I think this is, and of course, there are a lot of things which I don't tell my parents nowadays, and they're too trivial or, you know, and there's some stuff which, you know, will get them worried, so I don't tell them. Some things which are too insignificant, some things I just forget to tell them. But in general, I do tell them pretty much all the stuff that goes on in my life, good, the bad, everything. And I think that's the kind of connection that really people are looking for, for parents are looking for, that they don't want to be out of your life. And this doesn't require you to be physically present with your parents. I mean, you could be staying in the same house. And this is, you know, when I was growing up and pretty much everything was a joint family. I've seen dysfunctional joint families. I was, you know, oh God, I've seen more dysfunctional joint families than functional joint families. And in these 80s movies that you see, you know, nowadays they sound silly, you know, people, you know, fighting over who got, you know, the biscuits and who stolen the apples, which brother took the apple and stole it under the bed. You know, you look at them and you laugh, but then you realize these are actually true. These things used to happen in those days. So this, I mean, it's a concomitant of poverty in a way that, you know, the best thing in my life is I bought an apple and I don't want to give it to my father or I don't want to give it to my brother. I'll keep the apple under the bed. There's a Bengali movie where there's a huge fight about apples and stuff, if I remember. It was any Chota Bo. But, you know, they look funny and we can laugh at it, but this is precisely the kind of things that used to trigger fights in joint families. So in a way, it's not that if you stay together, you necessarily communicate well either. As a matter of fact, I believe that it's important that you have a certain separation in order for communication to be to the resolution that you want it to be. Because if I stayed at the same place as my parents would know everything that was going on in my life. And I would know everything that was going on in their life. And I don't think that, you know, any relationship can survive functionally in that kind of unregulated information sharing. So in you do want to share information with your parents, but you also want to be in charge of sharing what you want to share and what you don't want to share. And physically being in the same place, you just don't have that, you don't have that independence to do it. So summing up, I think that for me, the guilt, if there is any, the guilt is that if when my parents are sick, I can't do anything. That is there. And I worry for them, especially during these COVID times, And I know that my parents are getting old and, you know, of course, the inevitability and everything. It's a gazillion number of things that, you know, I keep away because I don't want to deal with it. But other than that, I definitely feel that just because you stay in a different country from your parents doesn't necessarily mean that your relationship is weaker than if you had been with them. I think technology and good intent on both sides, that's important. And for me, it's what I tell myself is, and again, I mean, I fight with my parents. I've always fought with my parents. But I also love them a lot. And I think of them a lot. And it's not that, again, I want to involve them in anything, but when I fall sick or when I feel worried or something, I do talk to my parents. I think that's really the most important thing. And I feel that also, that would be really what I would expect from my daughter. That when she grows up, that she doesn't cut me out of the big things in her life. I know that there are some things about her that I don't want to know. She doesn't want to tell me. And I don't want to tell her about my life either. But for the big things, and the big thing doesn't necessarily have to be I bought a house or I bought a car. We all know what the big things are. Big things are things which you know, emotionally affect us. That we have a reasonable amount of transparency between each other. And that there is no reason in this day and age that just because we live in different continents, that we cannot continue to be the same family. So, I mean, that's really the answer for me. Again, for me, as I said, it definitely helps that my father and my mother, for the last few years, they've spent 2 to 3 months here. So it's much better than, as I said, if I was spending 2 to 3 months in India, it's much better when they're here. You know, the interaction is much more dense and everything. So that's kind of, and as I said, ever since I've left India, my parents have been here for a significant period of time, much more than most Indians who are settled in the US. Because firstly, it was my father used to come here for years on as a visiting professor. And then after he retired, you know, he's here for 2 to 3 months. And I've been fortunate enough for that. I mean, but again, I know that this is, as their health gets worse, this is not something which can possibly persist moving forward. But that's the way I've handled till now. And I think it's, and I'm saying this from my perspective, I don't know what my parents think. I think it's gone pretty okay. So I'm going to stick with that.
All right. Is that our episode for today then?
That is our episode for today.
All right. So remember, our next episode is the hashtag Ask Arna Bray special. So remember to send in your questions on Twitter or email us at appodcast@foursquare.net. And as you could see, maybe some questions end up warranting an entire episode on it. So we'll take all your questions for the next episode. So until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.